March 2012, the very last day of the year. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for listening to me today and for listening to RBN, for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, you may email your questions or comments to Spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is Deanna at Spingola.com, but I do not access that email address during the program. You may join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to Spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Art from Philadelphia. His website is noplaceforcorruption.com. That's all one word, noplaceforcorruption.com. Alrighty, he is busy for just about 5 minutes, so I will first tell you about his website, and then we will get back to him. He is actually a listener to the program and calls in on a fairly regular basis. He has been on Rick Adams' program, and he has a very interesting website, noplaceforcorruption.com. And he talks about, well, he asks a lot of questions. Let me just go through the questions on his website. Who is the major figure standing in the shadows of 9/11? Question number two. If Israel and the Likud did 9/11, then who controls this? Question number three. Who is Netanyahu's power broker? Question number four. Why did WTC owner Larry Silverstein meet with Netanyahu every Sunday? Number five, who is in control of the Likud demanded that Sharon be replaced? Number six, what gangster paid for the AIPAC building in Washington, D.C.? Number seven, or actually this is a comment. Okay, it's a question. AIPAC controls 300 plus in Congress, but who controls AIPAC? Who bought the Sands Casino from Meyer Lansky? Who has expertise in controlled demolition from taking down the Sands Casino? Okay, I would rephrase that question. Who controls the diamond industry? Who is the third richest man in the U.S.? Who is this person? And the answer to all of those questions appears to be Sheldon Adelson. And he has a couple of links here, actually several links, and I do highly recommend that you go to, up at the top in the left-hand corner, it says Docs. And if you go to that link, you will see, you will be able to open a PDF file that is about 300 page book. And we are going to be talking about some of those items in that book when we come back from the break. As we scroll down, he talks about 9/11, and he talks about just a lot of other things. Alrighty, we are going to be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Art from Philadelphia. His website is noplaceforcorruption.com. Art, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna. How do I sound for you?
Pardon me?
How's my voice quality sound?
Pretty good. Although I don't know, I had to ask you what you said, so I don't know whether that's good or not.
All right.
Are you on a cell phone or are you on a landline?
Right now I'm on a cell phone. I had to run a transom, basically drive a cantry, And in about 10, 15 minutes, I'll be back on a landline for you.
Oh, okay, because cell phones aren't really as good as landlines. They just don't seem to have the sound quality. But anyway, thank you for being on the program today. Your website is quite interesting. And of course, the PDF document that is named No Place for Corruption, is even more interesting.
Right. Most of the work for that website is going into the document section into the PDF file. That's work I'm doing, been updating for almost a year and a half now, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And I started it in protest to the Anti-Defamation League program called No Place for Hate, which I stood up against in my local community, talked to the government officials who sponsored it, and they basically told me, says, we're registering you as a hate crime criminal, because I pointed out to them that the Anti-Defamation League and the No Place for Hate program was one organized crime. That was told to me directly by the police.
Okay, when they came out to visit you, apparently the ADL sent them out to your house?
No, the ADL called me up after I protested the No Place for Hate program in our local school. And what happened is the officials of the ADL then basically told me they're registering me in their national database as a hate crime criminal. I called the police. They came over and told me that the Anti-Defamation League is the mafia. Chicago Syndicate.
Okay. Well, we know that a lot of things are centered here in Chicago. A lot of things have been incorporated here in Chicago. More organizations than I can actually remember, but we're talking about a lot of the organizations. I believe the American Medical Association is in Chicago. A lot of the organizations, B'nai B'rith has an organization here in Chicago. I know that when I was doing my second book and in the research for my third book, Chicago kept coming up numerous times. So Chicago seems to be a focal point, and of course it's in the center of the country, so it makes sense that it would be an area that would be interesting or of interest to people who have a need to have a need to control an entire country. We often think of Washington as being in control, but then we have to say, well, who's in control of Washington?
Right. And I did the analysis going back all the way to the St. Valentine's Massacre up and brought it forward to say, what are the implications of that for what's happening to us in our everyday lives and our everyday community right now? And
yeah.
I've seen that it's directly impacting the outsourcing, the school busing, the control of the media, the control of our political system, the Wall Street. And when I did all this analysis, you're saying who's in control. It looks like the power base that we call Chicago really is in Las Vegas. That's the real power structure. The real guys at the top inside the country seem to be there, and obviously Wall Street. That seems to be where most of the power resides at this point, is in those players at those locations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But organization-wise, do they actually have organizations set up there? Or is
yes.
it just one individual that is there?
No, there's organizations. I mean, Las Vegas was set up by the Chicago Syndicate. I mean, it's going
okay.
back to, you know, it's been there for a long time. But if you look at how it evolved, the man at the top right now seems to be Sheldon Adelson. He took over after Meyer Lansky got too old and took the reins of power. And he seems to be the one who's the real power broker on top of all this. He controls Mitt Romney's election. He was a major sponsor of that. He controls Eric Cantor, who's right underneath Boehner in the House of Representatives. He's got, you know, lots of people in the Senate, like McCain in his pocket. He's got Lieberman in his pocket. You know, there's quite a few people there. He controls the American Israeli Political Action Committee, AIPAC, which has 300 members of Congress and majority of the Senate in his pocket. He controls the Zionist Organization of America. He controls Lugovich. You know, he bought the Sands Casino interest directly from Meyer Lansky. But when you get a look at it, it seems like, you know, obviously he is one of the centerpieces of this power structure.
Okay. But of course, this power structure was set up probably long before he was born. When was he born?
He's like 80 or 90. I think he's around 80 years old at this point. Yes, that's correct. I mean, it goes all the way back to the St. Valentine's Massacre when this power structure was set up. That's when it was really set up.
Okay. So they had influence before that, but then they just got stronger, and he is he's in charge of all of it?
His group is in charge of all of it. I mean, basically, the group, he's basically a focal point for the power. What I'm trying to say is there was a book called Taken of America 1-2-3, which Bruce Willis talked about in his, when somebody asked him about the assassination of President Kennedy, and he says, well, if there was a power control group, which is what they call this, identified as power group in the assassination of the president, he says it would still be around and existing today. And that's what I'm talking about in the place for corruption.com on the document section, that power control group, who it is, what it is, and how they're doing it. I know exactly who it is. And okay. Unfortunately, where I live, it seems like this is one of, you know, where I live is a place, you know, outside of Philadelphia, a place called Bucks County, that has been run by these criminals for three generations. We have my Lansky family lives here. We have Jack Ruby's family lives here. We have the head of the Russian mafia, Sergei Mogilevich, could have gone any place on the planet. He comes here. Why are they coming here?
Indeed, why are they coming there?
Because this is one of the places where they have a lot of control over the politics. There was a, in three generations, what we have here as far as the politics, it went through the Pennsylvania Republican Party, which is controlled by the what they call the Bucks County Republican Party. It's called BucksScott.org. This is a major power base on the political side for organized crime in our nation. And as an example, what happened is it started with Moses Vandenberg, who was the right-hand man of Capone, when they set up the National Crime Syndicate in Atlantic City. Meyer Lansky was there, which is a wife, Anna Citron, to celebrate the honeymoon. Anna Citron lives in Bucks County right now. Now, what happened is Moses came back to Philadelphia when Al Capone got, after they had been, Al Capone got arrested and went to Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. Spent about a year in jail there. That was happened a few weeks after, after the St. Valentine's Massacre, and then after they had the National Crime Syndicate meeting in Atlantic City. He was there, Al Capone was then protected by Moses Vandenberg. Okay, that implies that Moses Vandenberg was powerful enough in the political machine of Pennsylvania, in particular southeastern Pennsylvania, to protect a major organized crime boss like Al Capone from being prosecuted for the murders of St. Valentine's Massacre.
Okay.
It was also what happened at that point was it's documented that Al Capone used the Detroit Purple Gang to execute the, the members of the, the members who were knocked off in the St. Valentine's Massacre. Okay. So what really happened was, St. Valentine's was a merger, like a merger and acquisition of corporations where they merged, the O'Banion Gang, which was formerly controlled by Moses Vandenberg, and also, the Detroit Purple Gang, and they all became one organization known as the Chicago Syndicate. So the Purple Gang was predominantly Jewish mafia, and most of them came out of Russia, from communist Russia, and they merged from the St. Valentine's Massacre into the Chicago Syndicate. That's what my analysis showed.
Okay, now Lansky, I believe, came from Poland and
correct.
In 1911. Which is kind of interesting because that's just, pre-World War I.
Right.
I believe that a lot of the tribe seem to know when warfare is going to be erupting in their country, and they seem to move just in time to escape all of the disaster.
Yes, I would agree. And I remember you did a show on this where you talked about the moving from Germany, the Frankfurt area, around 1850 to the United States in Illinois, basically helping Abraham Lincoln Bronstein get elected to president of the United States, correct?
Well, actually, a lot of the people, not just from Frankfurt, but from all of the failed revolutions in Europe, the 1848 socialist revolutions in Europe, 500,000 people came over, and right. And they participated in the on the Union side to totally destroy the more the they were the more secular half of the country, and they totally just wiped out the South, the infrastructure, you know, a lot of the civilians and everything. But anyway, we do have to go to a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Art from Philadelphia. And in your booklet, in your, I shouldn't say booklet, it's a full-size book, but in your book, you mentioned the protocols, and I just wanted to make mention of the protocols. In fact, you start on page 33, which I would like to have you talk about sometime during the program. I did have an audio file of the protocols on my website, but I was running out of space, and it's a very large file. It's a three-hour program, a little over three-hour program. And so I had to take it off, and then I moved some other things off my website, hoping to have sufficient room, and I tried to upload it back onto the site this morning, and still too big. So I'm trying to clean up some useless material on my website, and hopefully I can get that back soon. Okay, Art.
Yes.
Are you still on your cell phone?
On my cell phone. Next break, I should be on a landline.
Okay. That's great. All righty. So we were talking about Meyer Lansky. We were talking about the fact that some of these people just know when to get out of town and out of the country that they are living in. And this is certainly true of the Lanskys, and it certainly altered the composition of our country over here, not only just because of the so-called Civil War, but because of the crime spree that they all went on after they arrived. They kind of took over, the Jewish mobsters took over and controlled the New York Italian Mafia, and Bugsy Benjamin Siegel, Bugsy Siegel, and Meyer Lansky kind of teamed up together, and it's been, they took over a lot of things. They had speakeasies and were in charge of Prohibition, and Prohibition, of course, was legislated into our country so that they could control the liquor industry. And it was Mafia in conjunction with the government that did this. Wouldn't you say that's correct?
Yes, I would say that is correct. Now, when you... There was a transition around 1985 is when the Jewish Mafia became the most dominant force in modern times in American organized crime. What happened prior to that point is the FBI and other government agencies were aggressively prosecuting the Italian Mafia, and they did a really good job of it. So roughly about the time that John Gotti was prosecuted and put in jail, they created a power vacuum that the Italian Mafia is no longer strong enough to control, you know, organized crime throughout the nation. But what the prosecutors failed to do was there's two sides to this organized crime. There was the Italian segment and the Jewish segment. So starting in the mid-80s, somewhere around 84, 87, the Jewish Mafia segment became the predominant force in our modern times, controlling organized crime throughout the entire country, throughout the entire country.
Okay.
One interesting thing, too, is John Gotti's father was Jewish, which means he was Jewish, too. His father was Italian. So that shows the merger of the Italian and the Jewish Mafia from the Gambino side. It's been there, you know, going back to the St. Valentine's Day. There's two sides of this organized crime. And, you know, at this point, it's really clear that the Jewish Mafia segment is controlling the show. All the way to Congress, all the way down to who hauls your trash outside, and who takes your kids on a school bus to school each day. Now, when you mention the protocols of Zion, one of the things in there, they talk about destroying the family. Now, they did that here in the United States. And one of the implications of the destroying the family is what we saw in Newtown, Massachusetts. Now, I know in detail how they did it. I went through this family court system in the past, had to fight for custody for my children, which I won. But when I did that, I wanted to find out who actually did it, who made the laws this way. So I did the research, and I found after talking with the father's rights groups and all that, they indicated to me that it was United States Senator Arlen Specter who said to them directly, he was the proud author of the Violence Against Women's Act, okay, which is, on paper, is to prevent, domestic abuse, which is a good idea. But what he did it in such a way that he basically destroyed the father in middle-class American families, took them out of the equation. Very similar to what happened with the welfare system in the 60s that basically took the father out of the lower-class family. So, I mean, this is an intentional program, and that was one of the intentional results, is to get the father out of there. What happens when you don't have a father in a family? One of the things is, the kids, the boys will go and get more involved with gangs and criminal activities that way, and the daughters will basically get involved with, disaster relations many times. So the factors I see what happened in Newtown was, one is they took the father out of the equation with the divorce. The government set up a system where they're not trying to, help heal the family, just trying to rip them apart and get rich off of it as they fall apart. The other thing is there's no health care, mental health care for the, severe illnesses that are created when a family breaks up, especially with the children. Then you also have pharmaceutical industry in there, getting rich off of medicating kids and not really fixing the problem.
Alrighty, we are going to a quick break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Alright, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Art from Philadelphia. Art, welcome. Are you still on your cell phone?
Still with the cell phone, but it won't land. Sorry about that. There's a dog here.
That's okay. Dogs are good. And cats.
Okay.
So would you also say that, of course, the women's movement contributed to the marginalizing of the family and the marginalization of a man in the home?
There was definitely a piece in there. Yes, I would agree that that played part of the role. You being a woman, you might have a better input on that point of view than I would.
Well, given that the women's movement was a kind of a precedent for the murder of 57 million children, I would say that it has a very huge part in it. And even the codification back in, I believe it was in 1920, the codification of the criminal law, and you brought this up before, had an impact on
right.
The way that criminals are prosecuted or not prosecuted.
Correct. Now, the one who did this, he was head of the Senate Judicial Committee, also head of the Senate Intelligence Committee in Congress, was Arlen Specter. He was the one who was one of the major sponsors of Roe versus Wade, again following the protocols of Elders of Zion to destroy the family with divorce, with abortion, and obviously, the custody issues that basically they forced the non-custodial parent to pay for everything. There's no really actual shared responsibility where it really comes down. So I see those are some of the factors that were done. So we are suffering, as we see up in Newtown, Massachusetts, the consequences of these people who have direct relations with the communism, the Jewish mafia communism that came out of Russia. And that's what we're suffering. And one of the consequences we're suffering there. There's two other cases I can cite in my area. At the state level, we had a state senator, his name is Stuart Greenleaf in Pennsylvania, who passed these family court laws. And one of the consequences was that there was a man who once visited his children, and he was an hour late to bring them back from custody. The wife called the state police, and he basically got in an argument with the state police officer. He drove 80 miles down Interstate 80 from Hazleton to Tobyhanna, which is a military area, a park. And the police officer and the father had a shootout. His son was in the car. He was unharmed. But that night, what happened is a police officer, mother, who was the father of three, and also the father of the other children, ended up in the grave, okay? Because they made the law so severe. In another case we had here, there was a guy named Daniel Traub, who was in what they call Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. He was the son of one of these kids that went to the family court system, and he basically goes up to a woman in a supermarket in the parking lot and basically shoots her in the back of the head. So we went to the trial. He says, you people made me this way by what you put me through with this family court in the divorce situation. So this is intentional, and the one who's benefiting from it is the legal system. If you look at the lawyers' organizations, the revenue base, one-third of it is from medical malpractice, one-third of it is from family law, and one-third from everything else. That's for the entire legal profession of the country. So why do they have any good reason to solve the problem? Because if they solve the problem, they'll put themselves out of work. So they're not part of the solution, they're part of the problem, many of them.
Right, you can certainly apply that to other institutions like the medical profession. Right. You know, they want everybody in the world to be sick so they can medicate everybody. And if they make you well by saying, oh, we'll just take vitamin C, that kind of, you know, they don't have any more business. So certainly that is true. They make work or make people have, allow people or orchestrate problems so that people will need them. And that's certainly what lawyers do. I mean, the ambulance chasers and, they didn't have any problems, and they wouldn't have any work.
Unfortunately, that's true. And Lincoln said it better than anybody else. In a town where one lawyer can barely make a living, two will do quite well. So when I see people like Joe Biden, who was one of the major sponsors of the family law situation, who used to ride on a train every day, I would say every week, with Arlen Specter down in Washington, D.C., and also one of the major sponsors of the family law situation, that they're going to provide the solution by preventing people from having guns isn't the problem. The problem is Congress. If
sure.
You want to solve the problem, why do we have 95% of them getting reelected each term? You know, that's the real danger to our children.
Right. And Specter was also the person that is associated with the magic bullet from the JFK assassination.
Correct. It was both Specter and Richard Sprague who were the authors of the single bullet theory. Now, I have on my website there, noplaceforcorruption.com, in the document section, I did the research. His power broker, Specter and Sprague, and also Ed Rendell, and also Lynn Abraham, were district attorneys for the city of Philadelphia. During the time that he was there, city of Philadelphia was just as corrupt as any place in Chicago was during the Capone era. This was the Dilworth administration. So what happened is Richard Swiker, United States Senator Richard Swiker from Pennsylvania, handpicked both Sprague and Specter to go to the Warren Commission. Well, who was Richard Swiker's power broker? It was none other than Walter Annenberg, the son of Moses Annenberg. As a matter of fact, Richard Swiker's wife worked for the media that was directly controlled by Walter Annenberg. That's how close the relationship was. So now you have the son of Moses Annenberg, right-hand man of Al Capone, when they set up the National Crime Syndicate, basically through his power broker, United States Senator Richard Swiker, handpick Arlen Specter and Richard Sprague to go to the Warren Commission to set up a single bullet theory.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay, let's get back to the mafia. How did you become so, we won't say involved, because hopefully you're not involved, well, I know you're not involved with mafia, but how did you come to know so much about the mafia? I mean, they are somewhat of a secret organization. How did you dig in and go down the rabbit hole and find out all of this information?
Well, it was probably an unusual set of unfortunate circumstances. Basically, I grew up in a town in southeastern Pennsylvania that was controlled by the mob, so I was exposed to it since I've been 12 years old.
Oh, okay. So we'll leave it at that. And then, of course, now let's get back to the St. Valentine's Day massacre. When did that occur?
In what year? Late 1920s, I'm going to guess 1927, 1929. I did look it up. I don't remember the exact date.
Okay, and that solidified the relationship between two opposing mobs, is that it?
Correct. They had what they called the meet, was documented in AmericanMafia.com in Atlantic City with Meyer Lansky there and Lucky Luciano. And then they had a second meeting at the Freakodia Hotel, and there you had Bugsy Siegel basically say the Yids and, basically the Italians and the Jewish will no longer fight each other.
Right. Now it's on November 11th, 1931 in New York, Freakodia Hotel.
Correct. Correct.
Okay. Shall I give some of the names of the people who attended?
Go ahead.
Jacob Shapiro, Louis Buckalter, Joseph Stacher, S-T-A-C-H-E-R, Hyman Hulse, Louis Kravitz, Harry Teitelbaum, Philip Kovalich, and Harry Greenberg attended this meeting, during which the Yids and the Dagos would collaborate in what the press would call the National Crime Syndicate.
And that is the power base that assassinated President Kennedy, directly involved with 9/11, directly involved with outsourcing all the jobs, shipping all the manufacturing to China, destroying our clothing industry every year. Now they're destroying our high technology industry. They're outsourcing all that.
Are you saying that the mafia are the people that pulled off 9/11?
Yes. With the mafia, with the government. Okay. What happened is, if you go back on my website, newplaceforcorruption.com, in the document section, there's a program, a CIA program called Operation Underworld. Okay. Going back at the beginning of World War II, about 3 months after Pearl Harbor, where they sunk the troop transport ship called the Normandy in New York Harbor. So what happened is the Office of Naval Intelligence and the OSS got together with Meyer Lansky, who was working as the proxy for Lucky Luciano, to basically create peace on the New York Harbor so they could fight the war and have them cooperate with us. And that relationship that was established then continued all the way up to the present time for the most part. And the OSS became the CIA.
Right. That's true. And what, 47, when Truman ended the OSS and then just took all of the staff and all the personnel and put them into the CIA. Now, how do you see the Mossad operating during 9/11 and during the JFK assassination? or do you see them being a part of it?
I see them being a part of it. Okay. If you go to 9/11, Larry Silverstein was talking for a year prior to 9/11, was talking to Prime Minister Netanyahu, having lunch with him, for like every week for, 12 months prior to 9/11. Netanyahu's power base came up to the Bucks County Republican Party here. One of his power brokers is Stephen Friedman, not the treasurer up in New York, but Stephen Friedman of Duane and Morris in Philadelphia, who was his next-door neighbor. Netanyahu grew up in Philadelphia. Yes, he did.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just figured he was okay.
Little side note here. You got a big trash hauling company out there that's mob connected called Waste Management System. It actually started here in Philadelphia as Schultz Trash Hauling around the early 60s, run by a guy named Rodman Williams. It was then renamed Waste Management System.
So and they had a big upset here, what, 5 or 6 years ago?
I thought it was longer than that. Yeah, where they basically were involved with a major Wall Street scandal. That was prior to Enron, the one I'm thinking of. It was the biggest financial scandal with fraud Wall Street prior to the Enron case.
Yeah.
And the top management managing the financial accounting for that was none other than the executives of Arthur Andersen.
Right.
Now known as Accenture.
Hmm. Yeah, a lot of people, a lot of heads rolled with that one.
Not really. What happened is Arthur Andersen had two parts of it in the Enron fraud, where they were there, you know, the accounting side was shut down by the government accounting office, but the other side was made as an offshore company called Accenture, which then won $10 billion worth of contracts from the Department of Homeland Security, 25% of their budget. And Congressman DeLorio of Connecticut blasts them and says, what are you giving Accenture federal contracts when they're one of the biggest tax cheats in the planet? Okay? So why is the company that's directly involved with the fraud of Enron simultaneously had $2 billion in lawsuits against them from the customers for not doing their job right? And when there's 25 vendors bidding on the Homeland Security contract, why did Accenture win the business? Was it on their merit?
Hmm.
Now, who was in charge at that point? It was Tom Ridge. Tom Ridge was basically, his power broker was Herbie Barnes, big Jewish mafia boss out of here, out of Bucks County, through the Bucks County Republican Party, that put him in power. And and also you got Bush there, and President Bush, you know, Jr. And both of them, you know, had direct ties with the JFK assassination.
In what way?
Right.
Now I know that he was the guy that he was what governor during 9/11, and
yes.
Or was it?
He was governor.
And anyway, he is the one that that gave credibility to the idea that a plane landed in Pennsylvania, and then after that, he was made put in charge of Homeland Security as a reward, right?
Okay. All right. In Bucks County, one of the townships called Knox Mixon. His power broker came in, his name was Robert Asher, and says, this is the next person who we want to be governor of Pennsylvania. I have on my website there, the Place for Corruption.com document section, it talks about the Pennsylvania Governors Club, and it shows that Herbie Barnes put Robert Asher in power to run the Pennsylvania Republican Party. Robert Asher is the convicted felon when our state treasurer, Bud Dreyer, blew his brains out on national TV back in the 80s. Okay? This is the power broker of Tom Ridge. Okay? Herbie Barnes, he passed away too around 2000. His power, the one who preceded him was Walter Annenberg. And Walter Annenberg and Herbie Barnes were at fundraisers for none other than Arnold Spector with President Bush Sr. being there. And I got that documented there. So there's direct connections going way back to the St. Valentine's Massacre, to the power brokers of the St. Valentine's Massacre, going up to 9/11. There's a lot of detail there. I can't explain it in a couple minutes on a radio show.
No,
they can read the document.
And it's important that you said that, because on a radio program, you are essentially just giving tidbits to help the listeners to then go out and do research at your website, and naturally you can't give all the information that you would like to. This is just to introduce people to things that they probably have never heard of before, right?
Correct. You got it.
In one of our emails, you talked about Laidlaw, the bus company.
Right.
You talked about Greyhound Busing.
Yes.
And several other groups. And I am very close to, now, Laidlaw was organized as Laidlaw International, Inc., with corporate headquarters in Naperville, which is the suburb adjacent, the suburb that I live here in Illinois, So talk to us a little bit about this after we come back from the break. We'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Art from Philadelphia. So talk to us a little bit about the school bus situation, when it started, and who got the contracts, and all of the details. And then I would like to go back to some of the other things that we talked about.
Okay. What happened is in the 70s, the Supreme Court ruled that we will follow discrimination in our schools by school busing. So it was through the Rehnquist administration, which came up through the Arizona Mafia that put McCain in power. And then we looked at who got all the contracts. The bulk of them, I think it's roughly around 70% of all the school bus outsourcing contracts since the 70s went to Laidlaw. Laidlaw is a Canadian company that has, an American and a Canadian branch with direct ownership by the Brockman crime family. Okay? Now, recently, about 5 years ago, Laidlaw was bought out by what they call the First Group. Okay? First Group is a British company, and I'm pretty sure it has some direct ties to the Rothschilds and probably, again, just another layer between the Brockman crime family to control Laidlaw before the buyout, and who controls it now. So I just think it's just another layer of insulation to prevent anyone from properly investigating what they're doing. So, you know, if you look at the majority of schools in my area, in my state, not just the area, but the state, you will see this school bus is owned and operated by First Student Busing. Okay? That is the Laidlaw guys that are directly used to be owned by the Brockman crime family. Now, there is an idea I have that people could do something about this. Just like Rosa Parks in the Civil Rights Movement refused to give up her seat in a bus, we can collectively refuse to use that school bus outsourcing service. Okay? It could start with a single student refusing to take the ride on a First Student bus going to their school board. It could then start with an entire protest by a school bus stop, a school bus route, and it could be also done by the taxpayers who are property tax owners who are paying taxes to the school board saying, who is getting the kickbacks and why are you outsourcing our school bus contracts to the mob? And it's something we can do collectively. Right. So when people think they can't do something about it, there's an idea that'll work. I mean, you said Occupy Wall Street, what about Occupy First Student Busing and start a nationwide movement to do that? We'll learn a lesson.
Well, I think the first thing that people need to understand and to learn is who is behind this, so that they can in fact get a little upset, and until people do that, through people like you who are exposing this kind of thing, nobody's going to do anything. It's just easy to walk down the street and put your kids on a school bus and then go back home. But because we've come to believe that, oh, this is so helpful, now we don't need to drive the kids to school. I mean, most children walk to school.
Right.
Before 1970. And it's interesting, you brought up Rehnquist. He was also the guy that sat on the court during the Roe versus Wade. Alrighty, we do have to take a top of the hour break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and this is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. Our guest today is Art from Philadelphia. His website is noplaceforcorruption.com. And we were talking about the school bus situation. And who knew? I mean, nobody thinks about who's operating this big company. They just figure it's a nice service.
Yes, I agree with you. But when you look into it, it's definitely a mob-connected situation. The Jewish Mafia is attacking our schools in a lot of different ways. That's just one of them. Another way is the No Child Left Behind program. Okay? Again, that was set up by the Annenberg School Reform Institute out of up in New England and Brown University. I think it's in near Providence, Rhode Island, which was controlled by Buddy Siena, the mob boss of the Prince of Providence.
The Annenberg Foundation was set up by Walter Annenberg, the son of Moses Annenberg, the right-hand man of Al Capone, and it was basically promoted by George Bush Jr. when he was president of the United States. I saw on the last week, when George Bush was in Philadelphia, that they had a big rally there with Lugovich at JewishPhilly.com, controlled by Lugovich, controlled by Sheldon Adelson, sponsoring support for Israel right before they went in and attacked, I'm not sure if it was Gaza or Lebanon at that point, just at the last week of the term of President Bush Senior, I mean Junior. So they were screaming, basically, support No Child Left Behind, support No Child Left Behind. And it was obvious what it's all about. So as an example how it worked, in the city of Philadelphia, through Mark Swaker, who also came up to the Bucks County Republican Party, he was the governor of Pennsylvania after Tom Ridd left power, they set up the Philadelphia School Reform Commission. Swaker, say, you know, has a dubious reputation. I'm not going to go into details. You can read the website. But long story short, he sets up the Philadelphia School Reform Commission, and now the schools, the city of Philadelphia schools, have a $600 million debt, and they're looking to close roughly 40 schools. Okay, so what they did is they privatized a lot of the schools, charter schools, and the result was now we have the taxpayers on the hook that pay for charter schools, and the public schools are falling apart, and the public taxpayer, the property owners, are on the hook for a $600 million debt by this fraud. That's what really No Child Left Behind is all about. Again, another Chicago syndicate operation.
Right. And yet it sounds like something really good. Like everybody, like the government is so concerned about the individual. They're so concerned they want to help these little kids. And they exploit children constantly. For instance, with the situation in Connecticut. With the showing of all these little kids, and of course no parent, no human being, no adult wants to see children hurt. And so they are going to go along, if they're not real bright and astute, don't know what the government is using this for, they will go along and they'll turn in their guns and get $50 for the buyout or whatever, because they've exploited these children.
Right. And how did the police deal with the situation? Did they go in there with, you know, water pistols? Did they go in there with guns to deal with the situation?
Sure.
All right, so to say, you know, guns in the right hands with a responsible people will protect our citizens. Guns in the hands of irresponsible people puts our people at risk and at harm. There is no absolute safety mechanism, given the fact we have 300 or 400 million guns on the street, that you can stop this.
Right.
But you can certainly reduce it. I mean, if they really wanted, you know, there's things they could mitigate it. First of all, have an alarm system. Maybe have steel doors that lock down so they can't get from one school into another. A lot of things to reduce the amount of
damage
that can be done.
All righty. We are going to a three-minute break. We'll be right back, and we'll take your calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back. Today is Art from Philadelphia, and we do have some callers lining up. Do you want to finish up some thoughts that you may have had before we went to the break?
I'm willing to take the callers if they want to talk, whatever you want to do.
Okay, and I would like to get back to the JFK assassination and Michael Collins Piper's book and how you view the association of the Mossad and the Mafia as he... because I know you've had conversations with him. But let's go ahead and take Jeff in Vermont. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Deanna. Good morning, Art. Good morning, Art. Hey, Art, I want to ask you about this. I read this book called Supermob, and it was by a guy named Gus Russo. And it was about this guy named Sidney Korshak, who lived in Chicago, who was the lawyer for... Al Capone back in the day, and for Meyer Lansky, and he was responsible for pretty much getting Hollywood started there with all the money from they were extracting from a lot of the sales. They were funding movies, buying up press, and he was the main culprit and about getting a lot of the money laundering started from the Jewish Mafia and the Kosher Nostra. in that time frame. And it's kind of funny, though. I kind of have a little connection. I grew up in Vermont. My uncle sold a farm when I was in fifth grade, and a Korshak family bought it. And he had three sons, and they're all about me and my brother's age. And we're all on the wrestling team together. And his dad really never worked, but they bought like a 200-acre farm that my uncle, he died and sold it to him. And his last name was Korshak, and I didn't know anything about anything when I was in high school. And come to find out, I was listening to Michael Collins Piper, and he was talking about that, so I bought the books. And I saw Gunther Korshak at a wedding like 3 or 4 years ago, and I started questioning him about his uncle, asking if he was related to Sidney Korshak. And he said he was. And I started asking about, you know, about him and his uncle being connected to the mob and everything. And he refused to talk to me after that. And it was kind of funny, but yeah, it was Gunther's and Stoner's great uncle. And you can go on, I went online, you could check out the genealogy, because they came from, the Korshak family came from Kiev, Russia, and they migrated to the Chicago area in 1906, I think it was. But yeah, it was kind of fascinating, and I see Steven once in a while. He lives right by my parents' house, and he had a ginseng farm. He never did anything. He's like an old hippie, went to Goddard College. That was kind of amazing. I'm sure he just lived off the proceeds of his great uncle's, you know, fortune that he made off, you know, whatever he did, you know, stole a bunch of money and laundered it. But yeah, it was kind of fascinating how small the world is.
It is. They're all around us. I mean, in my place, my area, ran into Alan Rubenstein, the nephew of Jack Ruby, and asked him, you know, he says, yeah, he's my father's brother. He's known as the black sheep of the family. So this guy's a judge over here. And he's, when they put casino legislation through the state of Pennsylvania, he was reading the paper. I passed him at lunchtime, and he's literally drooling over the paper. Now, his uncle was identified under the Nixon investigations in the 50s as being a member of the Brofman crime family, the first one to put casinos in Pennsylvania where the Brofman crime family was, Sugar House Casino. So put two and two together.
Yeah.
What makes you think
you would think that you'd be living next to they're related to the biggest crime syndicate in the country. It was just amazing. I mean, they were nice. I mean, they were good wrestlers, and, you know, I mean, we're still kind of, my mom's still kind of friends with them, but I think they all moved to Chicago. I think they work for somewhere in Chicago now. They don't live in Vermont anymore. Their dad does, but yeah, it's just a small world. And they don't want to admit it. And he's really, it's weird because he's never worked his whole life, and he's, I don't know. It's just, once you learn and see what these people do, it's kind of amazing.
I don't think all of them left Vermont because, didn't Ron Paul lose the elections up there? And some of the places where they polled the people, they said they all voted for Ron Paul, and McCain, who's tied in the mob, wins the elections at those polls. I'm not so sure if Sidney Korshak's goons from the mafia left Vermont. That's what you're alluding.
Yeah, I think Vermont is 98% white, and we have the best gun laws in the country. You don't have to register your firearms. It's a haven for, it's a big ski area, and it's just a huge playground for New York City and Boston and Jersey. You know, we just, you know, Connecticut, you go into Vermont, you know, most of the time you don't see anybody with Vermont plates. They're all out of state plates. And so it's just a huge playground, and you know, it's just the way that it's run by the liberals, but the liberals like their guns too, you know, not where they live, but in their vacation homes or whatever. I mean, most of the houses out here, they're just million-dollar mansions. People live here, you know, 1 week a year or whatever. But, you know, then the locals, like, we take care of them. And, you know, we're just a big tourist area for the rich people, pretty much. That's all Vermont is. It's a big playground for the wealthy people in New York City and Jersey and Massachusetts.
I think that's also true for places in Wisconsin. When you're talking about the Chicago mob, they all seem to have houses north up in Wisconsin and Eagle River and some of those places where you have a lot of mansions that are on the lake. And in fact, there was a a rumor that they got rid of Hoffa up there in one of those lakes.
Actually, I know how they got rid of Hoffa. I know the real story.
Oh, okay. We'll have to talk about that, but I'd like to have you talk about Michael Collins Piper's book, and I understand you did have some conversations. Jeff, did you have some other things you wanted to say before we cut you loose here?
No, I just want to say you guys have a great day, and hope you enjoy the new year, and thanks. You guys have a very informative show. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Bye. Yeah. Are you referring to Final Judgment, I assume?
Yes.
Okay. I did research independent of Michael Collins Piper. I didn't find anything in the research that would dispute what he did, but I did find information which I put on that website would add additional chapters to what he had there. The assassination of JFK Kennedy was an evolution going from Operation Underworld to Operation PV Success in the war in Guatemala, where Max Fisher, the purple gangster leader, became so powerful enough that he worked with Meyer Lansky over the Bay of Pigs affair. The real issue of Bay of Pigs was to put the mafia casinos back in Cuba and get rid of Castro because he kicked them out. That's the part you never talked about. And then there was Operation Mongoose and Operation Zapata, which clearly indicate that President Bush...
Oh, absolutely. Yes, indeed. With his boat down
yes.
there? Yeah.
Right. Hmm. And then I was just doing some recent research. I haven't written it up yet. Operation Watchtower, which is... indicates that Barry Seal, Mina, Arkansas, was directly, chose direct ties to the Clintons. And also I got
with the gang stuff, the drugs. Mm-hmm.
Right. So the tie, this shows all that together from the presidential, you know, you show the Warren Commission, you see President LBJ there shaking hands of President Ford in the background holding the book for the Warren Commission. Then I show the picture there of President Ford shaking the hands of Edgar Brofman, and basically joining the hands of Edgar Brofman with the Clintons, Bill and Hillary Clinton, when they became president. And they said that Edgar Brofman was their best friend while they were president of the United States for those 8 years.
So, oh, my goodness.
Right.
Goodness. Well, let's take Andy in California. Andy, welcome to the program.
Hello, is this Sharon?
Is it who?
Sharon, I talked to Sharon one time on the radio before. I don't know, maybe that was Freedomizer. I was going to send her some information.
Okay, you've called into Spingola Speaks program. I'm Deanna, and you're talking to our guest, Art from Philadelphia.
Okay, well, you're being tape recorded for quality assurance, and that's where everything becomes a that's where it becomes a cluster fart, because we're a group of people in society who use our tape recorders because we have ADHD or dyslexia. And we've exhausted all resources. We've taken our case to the district courts, in the federal courts. And the best they could do is change the rules of court in the state of California. And we felt it was discriminatory that we had to fill out a form to go to board meetings, DMV, court clerks' windows, court rooms, to go in with our auxiliary of a tape recorder.
What does this have to do with what we're talking about?
Well, we're talking about transparency and expatriation. I hear in the conversation here all these conversations about the poisonous fruit.
We're not really talking about that.
You're not talking about expatriation or patriation?
No, not at all.
Oh, what are we talking about today?
You must be listening to some other program on some other network, because we're talking about the mafia and corruption and the Bronfman family. So, thanks for calling in, Andy.
Okay, we're just talking about transparency, because then we can avoid those people.
Thank you very much, Andy, for calling in. Appreciate it. But we do need to stick to the topic, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. All righty. We have a minute before we go to the break. Did you want to say anything, Art?
Yes. Just on a side note, in the state of California, they have the pension management system by the entire state called CalPERS. And why did they award the contracts to none other than Accenture, the same ones involved with the Enron fraud? Why, of all the companies out there, is a company directly tied with Chicago Syndicate, directly tied with Chicago with waste management and the pension management fraud running things? So if he wants to look at transparency, go look at the CalPERS contract awards. You know, start screaming about that.
Indeed.
California.
All righty. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Indiana, and our guest today is Art from Philadelphia, and his website is noplaceforcorruption.com. And there were several suggestions as to who that gentleman was that called in, going by the name of Andy. Someone said it was the ADL. Somebody else said that it was Edgar Bronfman. Somebody else said that he must have been on some various products, which I won't mention. Some of the people in our chat room are very, very humorous. All right.
Could I make a comment to that?
Please.
Let him know that I have friends in the New York Organized Crime Strike Force who are going to know about what he just said. I'm not kidding.
No, that's interesting.
Let him know about how he took out Vivendi and they lost a $5 billion contract. He'll know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we take another call? Let's take Lindsay in Georgia. Lindsay, welcome to the program.
Hello, Deanna. And
hi.
Hello, Art. It's nice to speak with you again. It's been a while. I just wanted to say that Art from Philly is definitely what is known as a Renaissance man. He's a man who can speak up on almost all issues with just the same ease as he could, saying what he had for breakfast or whatever. Anyway, I wanted to say that I think that it's wonderful that David Duke finally came out and said that Israel did 9/11. And it's only taken him what, 6-7 years before all the other folks in the movement said that that's what happened. But finally, David Duke came out and said that Israel did 9/11. Were either one of you aware of that?
I am aware that he is currently in Europe and in a country that prosecutes people for telling the truth. So,
oh, I didn't know.
So a lot of times people they do everything but say the truth. They kind of dance around it, but they do that in order to stay out of jail. And he's done enough jail time that he probably doesn't want to do any more.
Well, Daryl Bradford Smith of IamTheWitness.com lives in France, so that's why, you know, people give him a lot of problems about why he never discusses the World War II history, what really happened, as you have done, and you do so well, Dana.
He blames everything on the Jesuits.
No, not Daryl. No, not Daryl. Daryl Bradford
Smith. He just did a program with John Friend. And in the second hour, he went on his big spiel talking about the Jesuits. So, yeah, he does.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I wanted to add something about the Lanza shooting. There was a shooting a couple weeks ago where the man had, I think it may have been in Texas, but he killed his wife or something like that. And then after doing that, he went to some cinema, it was a movie theater, and tried to kill people there too, but guess what happened? And this is why it was never reported in the news so heavily as what had happened in Connecticut and also what happened in Colorado. There was a female police officer, and she was out of uniform, and she stopped this guy from killing more people. And apparently the reason that it was never reported in the news is because it shows that people who are armed, who are legitimate, you know, good people, practicing their Second Amendment rights, when you have a good person practicing their Second Amendment rights, who are able to freely carry their arms, if you have a lunatic or someone who's a criminal or whatever, and they're doing the same kind of thing that was done in Connecticut, then they can be stopped before they kill more people. And basically, it would have put the kibosh down on this agenda of what happened in Australia with Port Arthur, and what happened in the UK with the Dunblane massacre. They're trying to take away our guns like they've done over there in those two countries. And if that story would have gotten as much publicity about the woman stopping another massacre from happening because of her right to bear arms, then people wouldn't be so hoodwinked into falling for this trap now. And I just wanted to ask either one of you Do you think that people are going to fall for the same shenanigans that the people in Australia and the UK fell for in those two?
Of course.
You believe that the American people are that stupid, are that ignorant?
I think that a lot of American people are. They're very gullible, and they are very obedient, and they're very intimidated by authority. We are one of the most censored countries in the entire world, and we have been obedience trained. So a lot of people will fall for this. People who, in fact, I have talked to people just recently over the holiday, saying, "Oh yeah, this is just terrible, and we don't need to have guns."
That's terrible.
Art, what are your thoughts?
I think we need better defenses, but I think the real root cause of this was a severe mental illness, untreated, and the reason for that was the implications of breaking up the family, and it just leaving the kids fall apart.
If it was Adam Lanza. All right, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Thanks, Lindsay, for your phone call. Our guest today is Art from Philadelphia. His website is noplaceforcorruption.com. And I really, really hope that you will download the PDF file, which is also called No Place for Corruption. And it is, I'm just going to bring it up here. It is a 332-page book. And it has a table of contents, and it talks about communism, it talks about the protocols, and remember that the protocols are available, and I hope to get them up soon after I clean up my website. You mentioned Rahm Emanuel. I'd like to have you address him since he is somewhat of a big issue right now, particularly in the gun situation. All right, we do have several more phone calls, so why don't we take Yukon in Florida? Yukon? Is Yukon there or no? Yukon in Florida? Okay, I don't hear him. Okay, let's take Mike in California. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna. I'm curious on your end game scenario, assuming that they do go for the guns, on what the order of restriction would be. My theory is the restriction of ammunition, or through higher prices, or just tracking, or and the like. And I don't really have any idea on how quickly it would move, or the extent of where it would go from there. I like your ideas on what you think is going to happen.
And of course, Art, we want your ideas, but they've already been tracking. The first time that they said you had to register a weapon, they started tracking the fact that you have to have a FOID card, and they started increasing the price of ammunition some time back and making it less available. And of course, if you look at other countries, if you look at Russia, and somebody in the chat room mentioned this earlier, And in the chat room, somebody says, "Do you know what happened to the Russians when the Jewish Bolsheviks started taking their guns?" Or does anyone remember what happened when the U.S. told the Vietnamese to turn in their guns? Well, a lot of people were murdered by the government. So I think that when you don't have the opportunity to defend yourself, and it doesn't matter whether you're defending yourself against civilian criminals or government criminals, things are going to get really, really bad.
Well, I think that you're probably right, but I want to know right now what the focus is on rifles and assault weapons. And when you say guns, that's such a large category that I can't imagine anybody convincing the American public that they don't have the right to own a shotgun.
Exactly. right, because that's what you use to go deer hunting, and you have a lot of hunters. And of course, the fact that we have guns to begin with is because, well, it's our right. It's an inherent right, and it certainly wasn't to go out and shoot deer. It was to protect ourselves.
So do you think that there is going to be an effort to get hunting rifles and shotguns handguns?
Of course. I think they start with the little stuff, and it's a gradual kind of a thing where eventually they'll want to take everything.
So what do you think the time frame would be between the where the overt beginning would be? We've already established there is a beginning, but I mean to where it's obvious, to where you've got to do something, to where you've got a gun that you've got to get rid of, and the end game, to where they start out with your 30-round AK-47 and end up with your...
I have no idea. I wish I knew. But I think, Art, what do you think?
I think you'll know just by what's happening in the circumstances around you. It won't be hard to figure that out. I would say when you mention the expenses, there's a company called Cerebus Capital that's basically through merger and acquisitions buying up all the many of the gun manufacturers. So that's what they're doing, is they're doing it from a financial transaction viewpoint, just pricing the American out of it.
So just right. Right. And of course, the Jewish interests have always been in charge of all the guns, whether you're talking great big tanks or guns that they use in warfare. They have always had control of that industry. And so if they own the big stuff that they use in warfare, you can bet that they own all of the little stuff, too.
Okie doke. I really appreciate your opinions. I put a lot of stock in what you, the research you do, I appreciate it.
All righty. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Yukon is back. Yukon, welcome to the program.
Can you hear me, Deanna?
Yes.
I got cut off before. Listen, I'm gonna, Art, I have a question for you. There's a resort area somewhere southeast of Philadelphia, and it may be in Bucks County. I'm not that familiar with Pennsylvania. But this resort area is a famous watering hole for the elite of Washington, D.C., particularly the generals and the higher-level bureaucrats. And they rendezvous there periodically, and it operates much like Bohemian Grove on the West Coast. Is that possible? Do you know of a place like that? Have you heard of a place like that?
This is Richard Dwayne Willing, right? You thought you could get away with calling in here with the name of Yukon? That's
yes.
Kind of clever, actually. Okay, I'm sorry.
What I heard is they get together down at the New Jersey Shore near Atlantic City, and they do it outside, at least the local guys who are tied in with the big guys. Do it down there, and that's where they figure out who's getting the contracts and how the deals are going on. So they wouldn't do it locally because someone could listen in on that, and that could lead into a prosecution. So the resort area I heard was Jersey Shore, unless you heard something different.
Yeah, the resort area is very near a river, some kind of river.
Well, the river, there's the Delaware River washing across the Delaware.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah, and they have a casino there. It's Ben Sale in Pennsylvania, which is the hotbed of all this corruption. It's been there, you know, that's where within 10 miles of there you got Netanyahu, you got Meyer Lansky's family, or you got Alan Rubenstein, Jack Ruby's family, you got Arlen Specter buried over there, and his power base came up there. So that happened at the end of World War II, is when after the Operation Underworld, they basically shut down the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and then all the Jewish mafia that had contracts up there moved down to Bucks County in Warminster, Pennsylvania, and then they took over the government here. That happened in the early 50s.
Yeah, well, this place apparently has been a sort of a rendezvous area between Washington and Philadelphia and New York, and the powers that be get together on short notice, as compared to Bohemian Grove, which is once a year. I've only heard about it recently. I'm not sure about the...
Well, here's the one I heard, that it's in the city of Philadelphia. During, after 9/11, Dick Cheney came to Philadelphia 40 times to talk to the Council of Foreign Relations. The guys from New York and the guys from Washington rendezvous down Philadelphia at the Engineers Club, and they did that 40 times in like a five-year period. Is that what you're talking about?
I'm not sure. I'd never heard of this resort area before until just recently, and I thought, well, you know, it's just a coincidence. It's like, you know, it's so similar to Bohemian Grove, but it only happens, Bohemian Grove, as I said, only happens once a year, where this other place apparently is open year-round for rendezvous.
What's been documented in the, you know, in the media of meetings is definitely the Philadelphia Engineers Club in Center City, Philadelphia, where the powers from New York and Philadelphia and Washington get together, and they work with the Council on Foreign Relations. That's what I've heard.
Okay.
That's what you're talking about, a Bohemian Grove. That'd be the closest thing I know about.
Okay, all right. Anyway, it just surfaced, and I'm trying to pin it down, and I thought I'd put it on your agenda, given your agenda is covering the waterfront here very well. And thank you very much for your work, and I'm recommending you continue, whatever that
all
means.
All right. Thanks for your phone call. It's wonderful talking with you.
Okay, thanks, Diana.
Bye-bye. All right, what about Rahm Israel Emanuel? Now, we had an incident recently. A fellow by the name of Jeff Joe Black was on my program on December the 9th of 2011. I met him the night before. He was an objector to the candidacy of Rahm Emanuel as governor here in Chicago. And this fellow, Jeff Black, was homeless. He said he was homeless, and he wanted to have me take possession of an external hard drive that he had, and because until he got settled. And I had it for several months. I sent it back to him in August. But on the day after I met him at the train station with a friend, because I didn't trust him, and I wanted it to be in a public place, he was on my program, and he started pushing the Ed Sciarrini nonsense. And even though I told him the night before, I don't want to talk about it because I really just don't believe in it. It's a bunch of garbage. And so anyway, apparently, according to what I've heard, Jeff Joe Black was recently murdered in the Pittsburgh area, apparently on October 30th is what I found. So I don't know whether this has anything to do with Rahm Emanuel and the fact that he objected. He was one of several objectors, or whether Jeff Joe Black just fell on his head and died.
I don't know the circumstances. You're telling me this for the first time. I do know quite a few facts about Rahm Emanuel, though.
Okay, let's talk about him.
All right. Emanuel's father was worked for the Israeli Mossad, as far as I understand from the documentation. When he came to Chicago to become mayor, one of the first things he did is he put casinos in there, okay, that the good citizens of Chicago were trying to keep out. So first thing he did is put mafia casinos in the city of Chicago. All right, then there's the Chick-fil-A incident, where he talks about Chick-fil-A doesn't have the values that we hold here in Chicago. And he was at this podium. And what was the podium that he was standing at doing it, that you might see in some of the videos of it? And the podium says, Lugovich, basically a front for Sheldon Adelson, the major organized crime boss out of Las Vegas, who's directly responsible for 9/11, who bought the Sands Casino interest from Meyer Lansky. And that's who he's basically talking about, his family values. That's what I know about him.
Wow. Now, his father was a member of Ergen?
Yeah.
And
wasn't
was he involved in the firebombing of the King David Hotel?
You got the history up there. I don't remember those details. It sounds like it might be right, but I have to check it out myself.
Yeah. And Rahm Emanuel is a dual citizen.
Right.
And he did serve in the Israeli Defense Force.
So why is he not? Then he should be. He basically should be a citizen of Israel, and he has no legal right to be a citizen or mayor of the city of Chicago.
Right. Because he did relinquish his citizenship, well, not his citizenship, but his residency requirement. He moved to Washington to be in the Obama administration, And he rented his home, and apparently when he left, he took all of his belongings with him. And the people that he rented his home to came into court, and they said, they said, well, no, he didn't leave anything here. He left lock, stock, and barrel. However, they came into court the next day, and they said, oh, no, we found 100 boxes of his belongings down in the basement. We just didn't notice them before, or some such stupid thing. So it was pretty obvious that something happened, you know, over the in the 24-hour period. And so he was installed as mayor. And I do believe that he was installed for several reasons, one of which is the gun situation, because Chicago currently has the most guns, most gun control laws of any other city, and yet it has the most murders. It's over California. It's the second in the number of murders committed within the city.
Right.
I think there were almost 300 murders last year, or this year.
Right. And who created that situation? It was... the situation in the family courts and welfare that ripped the families apart, and then the kids grow up and they get into gangs, and you have all the gang warfare, which is the major reason why you have it. He knows what he's doing. He's a big part of it. I mean, there's no way. I mean, basically, if you want to say Rahm Emanuel, I would say the word gangster. That would be the best way to describe it.
Right. And you talk about gangs, and I've been talking recently with a friend via email about gangs. And it is interesting that they are attempting to seize all of the guns from individuals, but they're not focusing any attention at all on gangs. And when you consider the gang warfare in Mexico and what it's done to that country, and you see what is going on here with gangs that are getting away with a lot of things, it just seems like the focus is in the wrong place. And then when you look at any hierarchy, whether you're talking about prison or whether you're talking about a concentration camp, there are a certain element of the population that are psychopathic. And that element, that 5%, usually rise to the top of any situation that they're in. And I think that you, for instance, in prison, you have the worst psychopaths are the ones that control the prison, and if you're not obedient, if you're not doing whatever it is they want, then they'll kill you, or make it very difficult for you to live.
Well, the prison situation. I mean, we got the highest percentage of people incarcerated in the planet, proportionally to any other society over there. Not working. What it's doing is creating more gangs. It's not the solution. I mean, once somebody's violent and a menace to society, you got to do something about it. But there's a lot we can do with the prevention. This is where we as individual citizens, part of the failure too, have not done enough to help our fellow citizens not to fall through the cracks.
Right. All righty. We are coming up on a break. Did you want to add anything else about Rahm Emanuel? Let me just read something from Remember How Rahm Emanuel Got the Black Vote Out in Chicago by Promising Slave Reparations? Okay, we'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. We do have one last caller in the, and we also have an interesting question out of the chat room that might indicate just exactly what Rahm Emanuel's values are. The question is, and it's addressed to Rahm, he said, Rahm, do you still hang out in those bathhouses? All righty, let's take Dan from Oregon.
Yeah,
Dan, welcome
you.
To the program.
Thank you for accepting the call. Just a quick statement and question to follow. And this is for your speaker, the question. Needless to say, the forces that were in play with the JF Kennedy assassination still continue to be here, maybe under different names or different circumstances, but they're still there. The question is this. Do you think it's possible that there could be a military overthrow in the United States, either to hasten the New World Order or to stop it? And that's my question. I'll hang up.
I would say it'd be more towards to stop it. I don't think they have the military in their pockets at all. I think the military is very hostile to them in many ways. But at the same time, they're financing them. So as far as the military coup, I don't see that happening. What I see is they're going to continue to do gradualism to the point they get enough control, and I think they're just going to wipe us out. Just, you know, just like the Georgia guys done, to reduce the population down to 500 million people. And that's, you know, look at the Georgia Guidestones, that's the Rockefellers, which are now the Rothschilds. So if you think what's going to happen, I think it's either the American people wake up or we're going to see a situation, you know, in the future, like what happened in Ukraine under Stalin and Lenin. That's what I see as our future if we don't stop it.
All righty. Interesting. Another comment from the chat room is that Rahm's brother, Ari, is a filmmaker and is Michael Moore's handler. What are your thoughts on that?
Interesting. Obviously, again, it's shown their ability to influence and control the media and influence public opinion, what it shows.
Right. Well, it has certainly been interesting having you on the program. I have never seen the Guidestones, and I imagine that you have seen them often because you live, you don't live very close.
No. I know about them. I've seen, you know, obviously I've seen what they actually stayed on the Georgia Guidestones, and Sessions did it, and it's obviously the one who's taken over our country is the Rothschild banking interest. Same thing we had the first revolution for.
And,
when we fought the first revolution, we didn't fight the King of England. We fought the proxies that were in our country. So you're going to fight the Adelsons. You're going to fight the Brothman. You're going to fight the Rahm Emanuels on down the line. That's who you're going to stand up against. You're going to fight the proxies that are here that actually are exercising the power within our nation. That's how we're going to
fight.
And it's not, I mean, the biggest thing we have is two-thirds of the economy is consumer activities, consumer purchasing. So what we do with our purchasing can make a big difference. Look real close at who you're buying a house from, who you're financing a mortgage from. I mean, that's like 50% of the economy.
Right, right. Well, our time is out. Thank you so much, Art. Appreciate your being on the program today. We will not be live tomorrow. We'll have a rebroadcast, and we'll talk to you on Wednesday. Bye-bye.